This hearing, the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, and the time is 2:32. We are in Butchovich Room 205. Members present are Senator Tobin, Senator Giesel, myself, Senator Dunbar. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. We'll expect Senator Myers and Senator Klayman along shortly. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Susan Quigley from the Juni LAO for staffing the committee today. We have only one item on our agenda, but it's a big one. We will have the initial hearing on SB 281, Healthcare Compact's Rural Health Program. This bill is sponsored by the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. During today's hearing, we will hear a sponsor statement and sectional analysis from our committee aide, Ariel Harbinson, followed by invited testimony on each compact. I should mention here, we do anticipate a CS, a fairly substantial CS on this bill. There are some portions that we will probably excise from the bill, namely the PA scope of practice legislation. And so we will not be discussing that today. And there are other portions we have already spoken with the Department of Health about revising. And so folks should get me their ideas about potential CS, but just to let you know that there will be a CS. For now, though, let's start to go through this. Invited testifiers, we have Carl Sims, a program director for the National Center for Interstate Compacts, Megan Hall, the former president of the Alaska Academy of Physicians Assistant, Donnie Woodyer, the executive director of the Interstate Commission for EMS Personnel Practice, Marvel Ragundin, executive director of Alaska Psychological Association, and Pam Venkin, director of the Alaska State Medical Association. In addition, we have in the room Sylvan Robb, the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and online for questions. Let's see if this is actually the case. We do. We have Janet Orwig, the executive director of SciPact, and Brian Webb, the State Emergency Medical Services Training Coordinator. So, Ms. Harbinson, if you would please set yourself up there at the desk and begin with the sponsor statement.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, Ariel Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. I'm going to start with a sponsor statement. We are looking at SB 281 today, Healthcare Compact's Rural Health Program. As you all know, in December 2025, the Department of Health was awarded the $272 million for the Rural Health Transformation Program. Alaska may score higher in subsequent rounds of funding if the state enacts certain compacts, though the scoring process at this point is opaque. There were five compacts that were requested in our application. Today, we are going to look at four of them. SB 281 would enact Alaska's participation in the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, the PA Licensure Compact, Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, and the EMS Personnel Licensure Interstate Compact. These compacts create streamlined pathways for physicians, physicians assistants, emergency medical services personnel, and psychologists to obtain expedited licenses across state lines. By joining these existing multi-state agreements, it is possible that Alaska could improve healthcare access, enhance workforce mobility, and reduce administrative barriers while preserving state regulatory authority. The purpose of introducing the bill in this committee is really to hear from stakeholders and to determine whether these compacts will be in Alaska's best interest.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Harbison. Do folks have questions before we go to the first invited testifiers? I don't see anyone. So we're going to start with Carl Sims, the program director for the National Center for Interstate Compacts. Mr. Sims is joining us via Teams. We'll provide a brief presentation on interstate compacts. Mr. Sims, I should say, before you begin your presentation, and there are certainly members of the public for whom this is new, it is not new for this committee. We have had many conversations about this. And so I guess I would sort of urge you to be as brief as possible when it comes to the kind of the basics of this. I think we have heard a number of interstate compacts bills, but please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar and members of the committee. Carl Sims, for the record, Program Director for the Council of State Governments. We'll begin with my first slide here, and I think I have someone progressing the slides in the room. Is that correct? Okay, thank you. So just to establish a baseline here about what is interstate compact, simply it's a legislatively enacted agreement between two or more states. States use interstate compacts to collaboratively address a shared issue where they can either leverage resources together or otherwise have a shared policy that they can tackle an issue. So it's a way for states to share their sovereignty with one another to address those issues. Next slide, please. So state participation in compacts, 42 compacts on average is what states are a part of. Alaska is a member of 31 compacts, and we're tracking over 275 that are in existence. So these can range to really any policy area that states may need a better way to collaborate. So anything from emergency management to higher education to criminal justice. Next slide, please. So looking at licensure compacts, specifically three primary policy goals for us to identify here. One, to facilitate multi-state practice. So where states each have their own different policies as to how someone can achieve licensure in a state, that can create a barrier when someone is trying to get licensed in another state, being that there's a new process and new set of qualifications. So what compacts do is help streamline that process by providing a uniform standard and process for practitioners to utilize. It also helps protect public health and safety by establishing minimum standards, as well as establishing ways that states can better collaborate and share information about disciplinary actions. Next slide, please. So for licensure compacts, the compact is developed for a particular profession, so it's unique to the regulatory, how states are currently regulating that profession, and states can join the compact by enacting the model legislation. Next slide, please. Here's a look at the participation across states for licensure compacts. So there are currently 21 compacts that are available. Many of those have been formed within the past few years. So these numbers continue to grow, but you'll see here the states in the darker shade of blue have enacted more licensure compacts than those in the lighter shade. Next slide, please. This isn't an exhaustive list of the licensure compacts, but at least isolating those that are currently introduced for Alaska's legislative session this year, as well as the two compacts that Alaska is currently a part of, just so you can see what the current membership looks like across states, territories, and Washington, D.C. for those respective compacts. Next slide, please. So keying in on some benefits and responsibilities for those using the compact primarily. So for practitioners, they voluntarily select to use the compact. So the compact does not in any way prevent the existing pathways to licensure for a state to be utilized by practitioners. So again, it's voluntary. The practitioner must meet those uniform requirements that are established in the compact legislation and pay any related fees by the compact member state or the compact commission may issue. And then their benefits, of course, being have more of a certainty of a process and standards for multi-state practice, an expedited timeline to receive that authorization to practice, as well as benefits on streamline for renewal. Next slide, please. And then for licensing boards, their responsibilities participating in the Compact Commission, the government agency that's formed by the compact and is comprised of compact member states. They are also responsible for submitting information to the compact data system and complying with commission rules. Their benefits, they're getting access to that data system where it helps them streamline those process authorizations practice and allow for better collaboration across states, including for disciplinary actions.
Mr. Sims, can I pause you there for a second?
Yes, sir.
First of all, I want to note for the record, we've been joined by Senator Myers. So this access to shared data systems, is that universal and sort of complete? That is there any data that some of the interstate compact organizations withhold from the states, or is it all available to the states?
Yes. So in each of the compact legislation, it does call for the creation of a data system. The data system is what makes the compact work. So for each compact, it's unique to the profession about how the compact will approach that. So for some of these professions such as the physical therapy compact, there's already a data system that's in use by that profession, the licensing boards using that. So that's been adapted for the uses of the compact. For other compacts, such as the physician assistance compact, there isn't a current data system, so it's the compact commission's responsibility to build the data system, and they're doing that right now.
Another question I have is, in a different discussion on compacts generally, it was raised that if there are compact license holders moving in and out of our state that have had disciplinary actions elsewhere, that there's no automatic way that the state becomes aware, or the state board becomes aware, when that multi-state license holder comes into the state. Is that true? Are there trigger mechanisms that inform the state when that person is here? Or is that the case, that a multi-state license holder, they can come in and out of states without the states being aware that maybe they have disciplinary action elsewhere?
Yes, I'll keep the answer simple. There are different models that compacts use. One of them that you just mentioned, with the multi-state license model. Primarily, most compacts use what we call a privilege to practice model. So to quickly explain the differences there, multi-state license, meaning that once a practitioner has that, they're able to practice in each compact member state, and they don't necessarily have the notification of a state that, hey, they got that multi-state license specifically to practice in that state. With a privilege of practice model, a practitioner is applying for or receiving a privilege of practice, an authorization of practice, in each compact member state that they want to practice in. So that licensing board, they'll be aware that that practitioner purchased a privilege of practice in their state. Now, as you know, currently with the system with a licensure, just because someone has a license, you're not sure when exactly they might be practicing in your state necessarily. But there's differences between the models that exist.
So you could have the multi-state license, but still have some privilege to practice requirement in the receiving state. Is that what you're saying?
So for the two different models here, the multi-state license, so like the nurse licensure compact utilizes that model. Someone has that multi-state license, they're able to practice in each compact member state. They still have to abide by the laws and regulations of the state of which they're practicing. And then on the other side, the privilege of practice model, the same concept applies. Anyone using the compact still has to abide by the laws and regulations of the state that they're providing services in. But the difference there is that a practitioner, instead of having just one license that covers all states, they have to purchase a privilege in each state they want to practice in. So there's at least that notification the state receives that this person purchased a privilege of practice in their state, unlike the multi-state license, where once they get that from their home state, they're able to practice in each member state.
Very good. Okay. Thank you. Please continue. Oh, I'm sorry. Question from Senator Giesel.
So you brought up the data systems that keep track of disciplinary actions. Those databases are available whether the state belongs to a compact or not. Is that a true or false statement?
That's correct. So some of these data systems for some of these newer compacts have not yet been formed. But it is the Compact Commission's responsibility to form them. And once they are, it then is the responsibility of the Compact Member States to start sending information to that data system. Compact Commission is comprised by the Member States themselves, so they're driving that process for the creation of the data system. But it is a mixed bag as far as which compact, if there's already a data system in place that the profession and licensing boards are already using, or if something needs to be created from scratch for some of these newer compacts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you. Mr. Sims, please continue.
Okay. Next slide, please. I believe this is my last slide, so just a few parting talking points here. First, just to reiterate, compacts do not interfere with other state pathways to practice. So again, the traditional licensure process, if the state has a universal licensure recognition policy in place, the compact is simply just another pathway to practice. Compact member states also retain their authority for discipline. So anyone practicing in a state with the compact, they have to abide by the laws and regulations of that state. And likewise, that compact member state can take discipline over the ability for that practitioner to provide services in their state. Compact commission, as I mentioned before, is comprised by the compact member states. Each have a delegate in place that again works to administer the functions of the compact, including setting up that data system. And that there is a revenue model for these compacts as far as member states being able to charge for practitioners that are using the system. Lastly, just as states voluntarily enter into a compact, they can also voluntarily exit a compact just per the withdrawal provisions that are outlined in the compact. Typically, that's just 6 months after withdrawal, just to allow an unwind period for practitioners and their patients to be notified. And then I think my last slide is my contact information. So I'd be glad to answer any further questions the committee might have. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sims. So I have a question, again, sort of about these compacts broadly. And each compact is a bit different. But in general, one of the justifications for these compacts in Alaska is because we have shortages in these professions. And that's sort of one of the justifications, like the nurse compact being probably the most prominent example of we have a shortage of nurses, and so we need this compact to bring in more nurses is sort of the way the thinking goes. I would assume we have similar shortages in some of these other professions. I know we do, actually. Given the CSG is sort of broadly studying all of these things together, do you have statistical evidence that that compacts actually reduce shortages? That is, do states that adopt – because we know that there are shortages all over the country. Do states that adopt compacts tend to have, on average – fewer shortages than states without compacts?
Thank you for the question. I'd say a few things to that. First, there are limited studies that are out there regarding compacts. They are still relatively new. So with new compact member states joining and practitioners using them, the data is evolving on that. However, the most recent studies that we have seen regarding licensure compacts, and this would be for the physician's compact, and I believe the nurse licensure compact does show an increase in the amount of practices, the practitioners that are available to that state. And that's something that I'd be happy to provide the committee and submit for the record. I would also would point out that while compacts don't change the aggregate number of practitioners within a country, it does help with the distribution of them. So in thinking of specific situations also, such as continuity of care, of course, military families, there are also different case uses for them as well, aside from just helping address shortages. But I'd be glad to share those studies should they be helpful for the committee.
I think we would be very interested in seeing those. Thank you, Mr. Sims. Are there further questions for Mr. Sims? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sims, for your time. And folks, his email is right there on the screen and online, and so we might follow up with emails. And yes, if you get us those studies, very much appreciate it. Moving on now, Ms. Harbinson, if you would please present the sectional analysis relating to the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact and Physician Assistant Compact.
Ariel Harbison, for the record. I'm going to go over the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact and the PA Licensure Compact. They are contained in the same sections. However, I'm going to give you a couple of page numbers and lines to reference as well. So we're going to start with the Interstate Medical. That is going to be in the bill, page 6, line 20. And in the sectional analysis, we're looking over sections 2, 4, 8, and 13. The IMLC adds the state's medical board duties to implement the compact and creates a streamlined, expedited license pathway for physicians to practice across member states. A physician designates one member state as their state principal license. Typically, it's their state of residence or primary practice. And that board verifies the credentials and issues a letter of qualification. The physician may then obtain full unrestricted licenses in additional member states without completing each state's full individual application process. To be eligible, a physician must hold a full unrestricted license, have no criminal convictions or active disciplinary proceedings, and meet national education and certification standards. Fingerprint-based background checks are required as a part of this application. Each state retains complete authority to license, regulate, and discipline physicians practicing within its borders. Disciplinary action in any member state can trigger action in all others, and revocation of the physician's principal license automatically affects their license in all other member states. The compact is administered by an interstate commission with representatives from each member state. The PA licensure, or sorry, physician assistant licensure compact is also contained in sections 2, 4, 8, and 13. You'll find the physician assistant licensure compact in the bill on page 25, line 8. This compact creates mutual recognition framework for physician assistants. Rather than a separate expedited license, the PA holding a qualifying home state license may apply for a compact privilege to practice in any other participating state. Eligibility requires PA education, which is recognized by the Accreditation Review Commission on Education for Physician Assistant, current national certification from the National Commission on Certification of Physician Assistants, and a clean disciplinary and criminal record. Each state retains authority over its PA licenses and may discipline or revoke compact privileges for PAs practicing within its borders. A centralized data system tracks licensure status and adverse actions across all participating states. If a PA's home license is restricted or revoked, compact privileges in all other states are automatically suspended.
Very good. Are there questions for Ms. Harbison before we get to, I promise, the we'll have detailed invited testimony. Senator Giesel.
So I don't know if Ms. Harbison can answer this question, but the prevailing question is, how does a state know that a physician or PA is practicing in their state?
That's a great question, Senator Giesel. I think I would like to pass that probably to maybe Carl Sims or one of the invited testifiers for those compacts.
So, Senator Giesel, we have for the physician assistants, we have Ms. Megan Hall, and for the ASMA, we have Pam Venton.
That's fine. I can hold the question till then. My second question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
What is the fee? The contract, that's really what the compact is a contract that this state would be entering into, cites that the Interstate Compact Board, which we would have only one seat on, can levy a fee to belong. So what is that fee for the MD and for the PA?
So I am looking at the chart that was provided. It's a tabled grid in blue. And this was prepared by DCCED and edited by Representative Fields' office, distributed by Senator Dunbar's office. And under cost to state for Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, it says $0. And under the Physician Assistant Licensure Compact, it currently says to be determined. My best guess on that is because the Physician Assistant Compact is not operational yet. It's new. And so it was created in 2022 and still being finalized.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. $0. The medical compact membership is $0. Is that true?
Through the chair, can I request Director Sylvan Robb come up and clarify that?
Yes, she looks very eager to come join us. Director Robb, if you would please come forward and provide perhaps some clarity for Senator Giesel's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Through the chair to Senator Giesel, the cost to the state for the IMLC, the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact, is zero. The cost for a physician to obtain that initial verification of their background that then allows them to get the expedited process through other licenses through other states is $700. And then they would have to pay the license fee in each of the states in which they're interested in practicing.
Senator Giesel, you'll follow up?
I do. Thank you. So the medical contract compact would require the physician to still apply for licensure in Alaska. Is that true?
Through the chair to Senator Giesel, that is correct. So the structure of that compact is that you have a license in your state of primary residence is the way they identify it. And then once you have gotten that, you can get a letter from them essentially saying we have everyone in the compact has agreed to the same background credentials in terms of education, examination, experience, et cetera, background check, and that we as the home state have verified this. Then if a person wanted to come and practice in Alaska, we would receive that information from their home state, not need to check all of those things because we know that they have the same statutes we do, complements of the compact, and then they apply for licensure using that. So instead of every state checking that you actually graduated from medical school, passed your exam, et cetera, you rely on this sort of license letter of your credentials from your home state. And that cost to the individual is $700. But I do know that we have invited testifiers, I believe, Mr. Chair, that yes, live and breathe this every day.
We do. We have a couple of people. We have a question from Senator Tobin. Is that all for now?
For now, yes.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robb, you just said something. They would choose to come to Alaska under this compact. Would they be required to move to Alaska, or could they practice telehealth?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, they can practice via telehealth. Come to Alaska was a colloquialism for treat Alaskans. So my apologies for the imprecision.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. I do have deep concerns about us exporting our care to folks who don't live here.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Thank you, Director Robb. You might want to stay close by. you could even stay there if you'd like. I think I'd like us now to go to Ms. Megan Hall. She's the former president of the Alaska Academy of Physicians Assistants. Ms. Hall, there she is. She's online. Could you please state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, of course. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear.
Okay, perfect. All right. So Chair Dunbar, Vice Chair Giesel, and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak in support of Alaska joining the Physician Assistant Licensure Compact. For the record, my name is Megan Hall. I am a PA practicing in Anchorage. I'm also the past president of the Alaska Academy of Physician Assistants. The PA Licensure Compact creates a streamlined, efficient process that allows qualified PAs licensed in one compact state to practice in another through what's called a compact privilege. It reduces the delays and administrative burdens that currently slow down the ability of PAs to begin practicing, especially when relocating. The compact does this while preserving each state's authority. PAs practicing in Alaska must still follow Alaska's scope of practice laws and regulations, and the compact does not change or expand those rules. For the patients, the compact helps reduce the delays they face when trying to receive care. In a state as geographically isolated as Alaska, any added delay caused by licensing barriers only makes access challenges worse. Improving license reportability helps ensure that qualified PAs can enter the workforce more quickly, whether in person or through telemedicine, strengthening continuity of care for patients across Alaska. From a public safety standpoint, the compact also enhances protection by creating a shared licensure data system that allows compact states to exchange a disciplinary and investigative information efficiently. This ensures that any PA practicing in Alaska under a compact privilege has met uniform national standards and remains accountable to the expectations of every state where they practice. The compact also benefits Alaska's PA workforce. It reduces the time and cost required to maintain multiple licenses and increases employment flexibility, which is especially important for PAs whose families move frequently, including military spouses, an important population in our state. Our rural health transformation efforts depend on resilient, well-staffed teams that can deliver primary, preventative, and behavioral health care close to home. A more mobile PA workforce supports those goals and helps health systems recruit and retain clinicians in a competitive national market. In addition, Alaska's healthcare sector has one of the highest rates of converting non-resident workers into permanent residents, Roughly 20% of out-of-state healthcare workers eventually settle in Alaska. By lowering barriers to entry, the compact helps attract professionals who may build long-term lives here, supporting workforce stability and population retention. The compact has already reached the minimum number of states required to go into an effect and is expected to be operational in early 2027. Alaska has the opportunity to join early and ensure a smooth implementation when the system launches. SB 281 represents a practical, low-cost way to improve healthcare access without sacrificing regulatory oversight or patient safety. It strengthens our ability to recruit and retain qualified clinicians, supports our military families, modernizes our licensing framework, and ultimately ensures that Alaskans, no matter where they live, can receive timely, high-quality care. The AKAPA respectfully urges the committee to support the adoption of the PA Licensure Compact. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. I do have a question. So one of our prior speakers, Mr. Sims, described sort of two models from the compacts. One where receiving states kind of wouldn't know if someone was coming in or out because they have a truly portable multi-state license. And another where, while you might meet the requirements of the multi-state compact, you still have this privilege to practice requirement in different states, where you inform the states you're going to be there and I assume pay a fee of some kind. Mm-hmm. Do you know which of those two models the PA compact fits into?
Yes, of course, Chair Dunbar. The PA compact is the privilege one. You only have the actual license in your home or resident state, and then you apply to whichever state you would like to practice in within the compact for the privilege to practice in that state. So each state knows that you're coming because you apply for the privilege in that specific state.
Okay, very good. Are there other questions for Ms. Hall? Okay, I don't see any yet, Ms. Hall, but if you'll stay online, we might circle back to you at some point. But thank you very much for your testimony. If you have to go, that's okay too. I know you're probably very busy. But thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay. Next up, we have Ms. Pam Ventgen, the director of the Alaska State Medical Association. She should also be here via Teams. We can get them up. There she is.
Yes.
Ms. Ventgen, if you'll please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. For the record, my name is Pam Ventgen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska State Medical Association. We represent physicians and physician assistants throughout the state. The Medical Association has discussed the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact a number of times over the years. Initially, the association was concerned about encouraging physicians to travel to Alaska. Our concern was that they would perform surgery, for example, on a Friday, and then go back home on a Sunday and leave their patients without ongoing medical support. We preferred to encourage physicians to live and to work in the Alaskan community and support our local schools and businesses and be invested in their local communities. But things change. Companies that employ physicians are more than willing to pay their license fees in multiple states. And we have benefited in many ways from that, that change. So we have reconsidered our stance on medical licensure compacts, and at this point, we are fully supportive of the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. It makes it much easier for physicians to apply for a license in Alaska. Alaska is not the privilege model, but if the physician has a clean license in their state of principal licensure, and they join the compact or apply to the compact, then that initial state of licensure has verified all of their credentials and they don't need to reapply in Alaska. They do, however, have to pay the licensing fees and renew that license just like any other physician. So what it does is essentially extremely expedite the process of getting licensed in Alaska. So that cuts down the time lag that has been reported for a number of years, even though the medical board has streamlined the licensing process in very recent years. We currently have a residency training program in the Kenai-Salatna area that no longer is able to get residents to do part of their residency training in the summertime in Kenai-Salatna because it takes so long to get those residents licensed. By the time they finally get licensed, the time slot that they could do that residency training is over. We have also reports from the primary medicine residency program in Anchorage that those residents who've been in Alaska and are applying for an Alaska license, they have their residency training license, but they're now applying for a full license, and that takes months to complete those licensing requirements. Compacts are a national trend. Currently, there are 43 states and 2 territories that are members of the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. The Medical Association sees this as a question of when, not a question of if. And if 43 states and 2 jurisdictions are happy with this system, it could benefit Alaska tremendously. It does not change Alaska's Medical Practice Act. It does not change the powers of the State Medical Board. The State Medical Board is still, and the Division of Licensing is still responsible for investigating any complaints and taking any disciplinary action against licensees. About 80% of physicians in the country would be eligible for licensure through the compact. And the remainder, if they had some disciplinary action in the past, they could still apply for a license in Alaska under the current processes. There is no cost to the state. The applicant, the physician applicant, pays a fee to the compact for the convenience of having that compact privilege or the compact verification. They do pay individual license fees to each state that they want to practice in. There was an earlier question about telemedicine. That is not addressed through the licensure compact. It could be, there is currently, it is, Senate Bill 83 is a telemedicine bill that's currently under consideration by the legislature. And that bill is asking for pay parity between, so that telemedicine services would be paid at the same rate as in-person services. There has been some discussion in relationship to that bill that the pay parity would be applicable only if the provider was in state, was practicing in the state. I don't know the current status of amendments to that bill. A person providing telehealth services would also have to register with the division's telehealth registry registration process, so we would know who those persons are. The State Medical Association encourages you to support Senate Bill for Licensure Compact. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Venchin. So we start with Senator Klayman. Question?
I just want to make sure I understand. Let's say I'm a physician in Oregon. That's my residence. I've no problems, no license challenges or anything else. I've had a very solid record for 20 years, and I decide that I want to start coming in, providing care and coming up once a month for a week to Alaska. under the compact, I would have to do more than just show up at the office where I was going to see patients. I would actually have to go register with the state of Alaska and their medical board. I wouldn't need to take another test. My organ test, assuming they're in the compact, would be enough for me to be practicing, but I would need to either sign up or pay certain fees so that the state of Alaska would actually know that I was coming up to Alaska and providing services on whatever basis that I'm choosing to.
Yes. I'm hesitating because of the term register. You would only have to register with the telehealth registry registration if you were providing telehealth. Okay. We did pass legislation 2 years ago, I believe, that allowed for in your example, a physician from Oregon, if this was subsequent to COVID, if an Alaskan traveled to Oregon for healthcare services and returned to Alaska, the Alaska patient could continue telehealth visits with that Oregon physician only if the Oregon physician was providing ongoing care or follow-up care for the same diagnosis for that patient. Because we had a number of patients who, for example, in this case, they would, prior to that bill, the patient would have had to travel from Alaska to, for example, Portland, Oregon. They could stay in the Portland airport, call their Oregon physician, have their telehealth visit with their Oregon physician, get back on a plane and fly back to home, back to Alaska. Everyone recognized that that was not tolerable. So the bill 2 years ago allowed for telehealth services in a follow-up capacity for patients in Alaska. But if you were in Alaska, if you were an Oregon physician licensed in Oregon with a compact, licensed through the compact, you would pay the Alaska licensing fees so that you could come up to Alaska 1 week a month to provide your services. You wouldn't have to register because you would be licensed in Alaska, and every 2 years in the fall of even numbered years, you would have to renew that license if you wanted to continue to come to Alaska. You would have to meet Alaska's continuing education requirements, which are probably very similar to Oregon's continuing medical education requirements, but you would be licensed, not registered.
Right. Go ahead, Senator.
Hopefully a quick follow-up. My poor choice of your words in you using the word registered, I wasn't asking about telehealth. Okay. Let's simply take a case in what the Oregon physician does what they need to do so they can treat people in Alaska, nothing to do with telehealth. They pay some fee, and you've got a better word than I do, but that Oregon physician comes up. That person, I'm the physician, I would be known to Alaska as being providing services in state. My licensure compact makes it feasible for me to do that without having to take more tests in Alaska. But Alaska also knows I'm here and I'm on the list of people who are providing care in Alaska.
Yes. You would not have to take any more tests. You would not have to provide proof of graduation from medical school. You would not have to provide verification from all of the hospitals where you've ever had privileges. You wouldn't have to provide verification of all of the states that you were registered, licensed in, because you have a license that belongs to the compact. If Oregon does not belong to the compact and you wanted to practice in Alaska for a week, you would have to apply through the current system to get a license to practice in Alaska.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what it does, the compact allows you to avoid duplicating all of that verification process that is so time consuming.
Thank you, Ms. Venkin. We have another question from Senator Giesel. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What is the cost of a medical license today in Alaska?
Oh dear, I haven't looked at that lately. I believe it is about $400, maybe $425. I think renewal is similar, but based on my recollection of the last time that the division gave the medical board an accounting of expenses, I believe they are, when medical licenses renew in the fall of this year, I believe the renewal fees will go down slightly because costs have not been quite as much as budgeted for.
Well, Senator Giesel.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if the scenario occurred that the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact was adopted, the physician entering the state of Alaska would still pay the $425 every 2 years. We renew every 2 years here. Is that true?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll just note for the record, that is, the bar fees are currently $660 a year. So, Matt, we need to get on that. I don't know why it's so much more expensive than being a doctor. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. My first is just kind of a general run. What protections in these compacts exist for Alaskan-based physicians to ensure that their practice doesn't seek lower cost providers who reside out of state, maybe new in their medical practice, and this eases that transition of moving one expensive physician out and a new physician in because we've created this or reduced the barriers?
I'm sorry, Senator Tobin, I didn't quite understand your question.
Thank you. Let me try to rephrase. Are there protections in the compact or within the state statute that would protect existing physicians working at practices that are seeking to reduce their costs so they use this compact to replace the Alaskan-based physician who may have years of experience and be able to negotiate a larger salary with someone who's new, inexperienced, recently out of their residency, who is interested in coming to Alaska?
The compact wouldn't make it any easier or more difficult. It would, I mean, the new physician would still have to apply to that group practice or whatever, or clinic, whatever the setting was. But all it would do is shorten the application time. It wouldn't, I can't see that happening because they would join a practice and have no patient following, where an existing physician has a group of patients in their practice that they have relationships with. Those patients are going to want to stay with that established physician. Typically, the practice gets busier and they need more practitioners. But no, I don't think it's very common that an existing physician would be replaced by somebody less experienced just because they're cheaper to employ.
Second question, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up with Senator Tobin, then we'll go to Senator Giesel, and then I'd like us to move. We have two more compacts to get through, if possible, today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is particularly about the relationship between physicians and physician assistants. Right now, the state medical board and in regulation requires physician assistants to have two collaborating physicians, although I know that there has been some modernization to the regulation, and now it's moving to a one collaborating physician. Within the compact, would we be seeing more physician assistants potentially having that collaborating agreement with physicians who've never actually come to Alaska, who are not residing in Alaska, but now can obtain an easier license in Alaska? as we have seen, the collaborating physician who do not live in the state move from about 12% now to 18%. Would there be an anticipation that we would see that number continue to grow if we made it easier to obtain a physician's license here in the state through this compact?
I suppose that's a potential. The legislation that's currently going through, there are two modernization efforts. One is a regulation project that seems to be stalled in the Department of Law. The other is a bill, Senate Bill 89, which is your bill, that would provide for a physician assistant who is practicing in a physician-led, team-based setting, like a clinic with one or more physicians in the clinic, or a native clinic with physician direction, or the Department of Corrections, or those kinds of settings that are team-based, physician-led. Those physician assistants, the physician assistants tell us they collaborate with the most appropriate physician for the patient's care. And so if there's a team of physicians, the physician assistant doesn't, in this bill, hoping it passes, the physician assistant wouldn't need to identify a unique collaborating physician because they collaborate with the team in that clinic setting. It's only if a physician assistant were practicing without a physician director of the clinic or a physician-led team that physician assistant who was on their own would need to identify a collaborating physician. It's certainly possible that a physician assistant, and it currently exists, where there are some physician assistants who are practicing with a collaboration agreement with a physician who is licensed in Alaska but residing outside of Alaska. There's nothing preventing that now. There's would be nothing preventing that if we joined the compact.
Thank you, Ms. Vention. We'll go to Senator Giesel, and then we'll move on to the next compact.
Mr. Chairman, what I want to ask, I believe Ms. Ventigen is the executive director of the State Medical Board, which also oversees physicians' assistants, and my question is about the fees for them. Is that appropriate at this time, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, I believe so. Are you comfortable with that, Ms. Vention?
Yes, I'm with the association, not the board. I think that's what you meant.
Then she is not the appropriate person to ask. Okay. She will not know the answer.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. And perhaps we can follow up with the board remotely later, unless you have that, Ms. Harbison. No. Okay. So we will move on to thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Vention. We will move on now to, let's see here, actually to, back to Ms. Harbison, for the sectional analysis relating to the Psychological Interjurisdictional Compact, the PsyPact. Go ahead, Ms. Harbison.
For the record, Arielle Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. Again, I'd like to direct you to specific sections in the sectional analysis for the PsyPact. We are going to be looking at sections 23 through 28, and then you can find the psychology compact in the bill on page 58, line 23. The PsyPact covers two specific practice scenarios, telepsychology and temporary in-person services. A licensed psychologist in a PsyPact state may provide telepsychology services to clients in any other PsyPact state and may also travel to another PsyPact state to provide in-person psychological services for up to 30 days per year without needing a separate license in that state. To participate, a psychologist must hold an active e-passport for telepsychology or an interjurisdictional practice certificate for temporary in-person practice. The state where a client is located governs the applicable scope of practice, and the home state retains authority over their own licenses. Any adverse action taken or any adverse action in any SIPAC state immediately revokes both the e-passport and the IPC, the interjurisdictional practice certificate, removing compact privileges in all member states. This bill also adds fingerprint-based background check requirements for psychologist licensure consistent with SIPAC standards. I'm also going to note in Section 30 of the bill, it authorizes the Department of Public Safety to conduct national criminal history record checks in connection with licensure under all four of these compacts.
Thank you, Ms. Harbison. I'll just note for folks looking at the sectional analysis, this bill, the drafting of this bill was a little bit unique. And so it goes by compact, not directly linear by section, if that makes sense, because some of the sections they're not directly in order by compact. And so there are provisions that are a little bit mixed up in there. The sectional is broken down by compact. Thank you, Ms. Harbison. We're now going to go to Marvo Raguindan. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your last name. There's Marvo. And he's the executive director of the Alaska Psychological Association. If you could please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. To the chair and to the rest of the committee, thank you for inviting Alaska Psychological Association to provide public testimony on SIPAC. And for the record, my name is Marvo Raguindan, and I'm the executive director for Alaska Psychological Association. Our association goes by the acronym ACPA, and we were established in 1963. We have 150 members that also include the licensed psychological associate, that's the master's level, clinical LPAs, licensed professional counselors, licensed clinical social workers, and students. And I'm sorry, I didn't ask you to forward that slide for me. The Department of Professional Licenses shows that there's 325 psychologists with an active license, 20% of them being ACPA members. Next slide, please. As you can see by this slide, that there are 43 SIPAC jurisdictions, including the District of Columbia and a U.S. territory, the Northern Mariana Islands. And this represents about 82% of the states that are in the compact. Next slide, please. So where we stand with SIPAC, it's been on the legislative agenda for ACPA for a number of years and became operational in 2020. We learned about HB 352 in January, so we all of a sudden needed to start discussing it internally, because we had not made a statement on it or decided whether we endorsed it or not, because it has requirements to practice. And so that became the sole topic for our February and March discussion. After a long discussion, it was decided that we would poll our membership and then open up that poll, the survey, to all of the other psychologists in the state to get their feedback on it. In our March board meeting, the early survey results showed that a majority of the participants of psychologists were in favor of Alaska joining SIPAC, and this gave the board members the confidence to go ahead and endorse SIPAC as well as HB 352 by a majority vote, which would also mean that we would also be endorsing SB 281 as well. And the next slide, please. As we discussed the compact of SIPAC, we do note that psychologists need to qualify to participate in SIPAC, but it doesn't affect the scope of practice for those who do not participate. It does allow clinical psychologists to continue providing therapy to clients who move to another SIPAC state, as was stated earlier, or those who go to another SIPAC state for an extended period. So, for example, clients who move to the lower 48 or a U.S. territory can continue to work with their established Alaska psychologist. So can snowbirds wintering down south and students on break in the lower 48. SCIPAC will also increase access to services for psychologists from another SCIPAC state. This provides opportunities for those in rural communities, those who may need specialized therapies not available in Alaska, or those who prefer to work with a therapist who speak the same language or share the same cultural values, also not available in Alaska. Next slide, please. As stated earlier as well, the compact does have some very specific rules that, if not followed, could result in discipline by their home state, or the receiving states could revoke the authority to practice. They must hold an active license in the SCIPAC home state. They must obtain an e-passport certificate and one of the following: the authority to practice telepsychology across state lines, and temporary authorization to practice in person in another SCIPAC state. They must comply with the scope of practice laws of the receiving state, including any mandatory reporting and emergency procedures, and receive official notice of authorization from the SCIPAC commission before they practice. Next slide, please. As I said, we did survey our members, and we're continuing to survey. Within that survey, it did reveal some concerns from our participants. The first one shown on the slide is exclusion of graduates of non-APA or CPA accredited programs. That's the one that most people are aware of, but we've been informed that there are actually six pathways to gain that e-passport. This was a big concern because Alaska Pacific University is not an APA accredited program at the moment. SCIPAC's executive director, Janet Orr, who is also online with us today, feels that one of the other pathways will be available for those who graduate from APU to be able to participate. There's also concerns about e-passport holders unaware of Alaska's culture. Those from large metropolitan areas may not be aware or are not aware of Alaska's unique culture and the difficulties in accessing services in rural communities. So, for example, if a therapist in New York's not a SCIPAC state, the therapist in, let's say, Iowa says, I think you need to go as quickly as you can to your nearest medical facility, they may not be aware that that might be a 3 or 4 hour travel for them. So that would not be good advice from that particular therapist who's not aware of Alaska's vastness and what it takes to travel. Alaska is one of 25 states that recognize a licensed psychological associate, an LPA. That's the master's level. LPAs currently do not qualify under the SCIPAC rule as well. Let's go to the next slide, please. Knowing that there were these concerns from the survey, ACPA is committed to address some of these concerns. We realized that a number of the participants to the survey did not quite understand everything about SCIPAC, so we would hold a town hall meeting to help educate them. We would continue to provide continuing education workshops on SCIPAC. We can create continuing education materials for out-of-state e-passport holders. So, for example, just the other day, the executive director for North Carolina Psychological Association just announced that they had launched a couple pages on their website to help SCIPAC participants understand what it takes to practice in North Carolina. And that might be a model that ACPA also borrows and adds to our website. And then we would also collaborate with the other SCIPAC states to provide resources to Alaska and collaborate with them as much as possible. Next slide, please. So thank you very much for allowing us to present, or me to present, and I'll take any questions or ask Janet Orwick to also answer questions as well.
Thank you. Yes, we have Janet Orwig, the Executive Director of SciPact Online. She's available for questions. Senator Giesel, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. You know, I'm not an attorney, nor do I play one on TV, but I understand that these compact contracts need to be read carefully. And so, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at page 60 of the bill, which is part of the is the beginning of the compact. It is the, I'm looking first of all at the second whereas, which says it's intended to regulate the day-to-day practice of telepsychology, which is a very distinct form of practice of psychology. It goes on to say it is intended to regulate the temporary in-person face-to-face practice across state lines for 30 days. It goes on to say further down, whereas this compact does not apply when a psychologist is licensed in both the home and receiving states, and it does not apply to permanent in-person face-to-face practice, it does allow for authorization for temporary psychological practice. This is a very unusual compact, Mr. Chairman. It seems to focus on telepsychology versus the actual movement of clinicians across state lines practicing in another state. So I guess I would ask the experts who are online whether this interpretation is accurate of the writing, the words that are written in this contract.
Yeah, I think I'd direct that to Ms. Orwig, the executive director of SciPact. And I guess I'll add to that, one of the justifications from the administration who support, so though this bill comes from the Health and Social Services Committee, the genesis of it is because the administration made commitments to these kind of compacts in our rural health transformation application of the federal government. And one of the justifications for the compacts is it would help, for example, military spouses get licensed more quickly. But it doesn't seem like that is what this compact does. So do you want to speak to Senator Giesel's question first and then perhaps address mine about does it actually do anything to speed up folks getting permanent licenses here in the state? Ms. Orwig?
Okay, thank you. I am Janet Orwig. I am the executive director for SciPact, and thank you to the committee for having me be able to provide testimony or to actually answer questions. And I will, through the chair to Senator Giesel, I think that's how you say that. I apologize if I did not say that correctly, answer that question first. That is correct in your interpretation. When SciPact was created, it was originally created by the Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards, which is the organization made up of all the licensing boards across the states for psychology in the states and actually Canada. And when they actually approached the association and was asking for a way to regulate telepsychology, that was the component that they were having issues with. They could not regulate the practice going across state lines. As you know, telepsychology is a mode of delivery for psychological services, and it has absolutely grown, especially unfortunately due to COVID. We saw that as a huge increase. And so that is what the association started working on, was the telepsychology component. When they presented that back to the licensing boards asked that that temporary component be added for the 30 days in person, because each of the states had variations on what was allowed for temporary practice. And they felt 30 days added a standard to that that was not necessarily available across all of the states. So our compact is a little different. We only address telepsychology and that very temporary 30 days.
Very good. So I think then the answer to my question, Ms. Orwig, is no, correct? It doesn't do anything to impact military spouses sort of increasing how quickly they can get licensed in Alaska.
It doesn't increase how they get licensed in Alaska, but it does increase their ability to continue to practice if they are relocated and they can use that. The orders, I'm not sure the correct term for that, but they are allowed to use their orders that they are given to meet that home state requirement. So they would be able to practice under SIPAC if they had that authorization. So it does assist military, and the Department of War has been a supporter for SIPAC since its beginning.
Thank you. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. One might just be a point. On page 68, on line 19, it says for that temporary authorization to practice for the teleservices that the individual must have received an education from a regionally accredited accrediting body recognized by the United States Department of Education to receive their graduate degree. There is no such thing as regional accreditation anymore. The Biden administration updated it to be institutional accreditation. So just so we note that there are folks who are graduating from these programs who are not from a regionally accredited institution. They are from a different type of accrediting entity. The second part I am curious about is for me, the first consideration I have is about folks who are in our systems of incarceration. Majority of them are indigenous. I think some of the data we just received is a population of about 68% indigenous. And one of the things I know our psychology programs here in the state of Alaska really focus on is that community and clinical psychology that is culturally responsive, that ensures that we infuse that learning within the system. And so this might be to either of our testifiers is what protections or confidence can we have that folks who might be using this particular compact of practice in Alaska are prepared to deal with our very unique populations, especially if it's for that kind of temporary 30-day period of time?
I know that Marvo addressed some of that in his presentation about options and things that they would be working on, but thank you for the question. The way that it works currently is that a jurisdiction can provide us with information that they feel is specific that to their jurisdiction that practitioners need to be aware of. They can provide that sheet, and the authorization holders must acknowledge that they're going to abide by that. They also must abide by the scope of practice and the public health laws into the receiving state. So they would have to abide by what the scope of practice is in Alaska as well. In addition to that, they also acknowledge that they have read and will abide by the American Psychological Telepsychology Guidelines. And what those guidelines have done is they have looked at the mode of delivery for telepsychology and compared it to what an in-person face-to-face relationship would be and what are those areas that you need to address, one of those being informed consent, saying that I will know what the emergency situation is in your area. We also have a directory that authorization holders can put in, and they are able to put in languages, specialty areas, and any other information that they would like to put that will make sure that the client is aware of what the psychologist's specialties are and any languages they may speak.
Thank you. I have a question, actually, something you brought up. I'm thinking about there's a lot of variation in some of the law, the scope of practice, and sort of what is allowed. One thing that we've talked about here, and specifically with behavioral health, is age of consent to behavioral health. How does that work? If you have two states with differing ages of consent to consent to do these services, which of the states predominates, and how do you sort of verify that?
Thank you for the question. It is going to be the state where the client is. That is where the scope of practice would occur, as well as those public health laws. And an authorization holder sitting in another compact state has to be aware of and agree to abide by what those scopes are. The same as if they were getting a license in that jurisdiction, they have to be aware of what your statute is, your regs are, as well as any other public health laws.
And could you remind me, I believe that Mr. Rangadin said this, but how would Alaska know if this was occurring? That is to say, how would our Board of Psychology, how would our regulatory agencies know if let's say, there was someone practicing in another state complying with their, let's say it's their age of consent law, but not ours, how would our state know that that was taking place?
Thank you for the question. The licensing board will have access to a dashboard, which gives them access to all of the information for all the authorization holders. As far as a way to regulate and make sure or to know whether or not someone is practicing under that state scope of practice or their home states, as part of the authorization that is issued and the acknowledgments that the authorization holders agree to, they have to know that scope of practice and they have to be abiding by it into that receiving state. Failure to do so would be grounds for revoking their authorization, and then they would no longer be able to practice under SciPact in any state.
Would there also be, I mean, let's say in the worst case that there was actually some kind of criminal violation or serious civil violation, how would Alaska, and this applies to basically all kind of telemedicine, but here it seems much more widespread, how would Alaska sort of reach out and get jurisdiction over that person?
So thank you for the question. There's the disciplinary process is laid out in the compact as well as further defined in the rules that the commission has already enacted. But when an Alaska citizen has a complaint, they would file it with the Alaska board, who then has the authority to revoke the privilege to practice in Alaska if they felt that that was necessary. At that point, they would report that to the commission, and that psychologist is going to lose their authorization to practice under SciPact in all states. They also notify at the point of notification to the home state. So I'm in Georgia. So if I am not a psychologist, but I'm going to pretend to be one for this example. If I was and licensed in Georgia, I have the authorization in Georgia as my home state. Alaska would also notify the commission and the Georgia State Board that they are taking an action on my authorization there. The Georgia board must look at that and decide whether or not to take action on my individual Georgia license outside of compact authorization that would have already been lost because of the action in Alaska.
Thank you. Senator Giesel, and then we're going to try to get to EMS. Thank you.
I understand, Mr. Chairman, but it raises the question of license fees. So this telepsychiatry being provided, will that provider be paying a fee to the board in Alaska for the privilege of practicing telepsychology here?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, no, Senator Giesel, there is not a fee that will be paid to the licensing board in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Sherman, that raises questions of cost. To do an investigation is very expensive for a licensing board. So it sounds very good that we would be able to discipline them, but there has to be an investigation verifying that they have in fact violated our laws and consequently will be disciplined.
Thank you.
May I add something to that comment?
Go ahead, Ms.
And I promise it'll be quick. We have been in existence since 2019, and we issued our first authorization in 2020, and we have not had any jurisdiction under SciPact report an investigation of anyone practicing in their state through SciPact. I just kind of wanted to highlight that doesn't mean it's not going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Orwig. Senator Klayman.
I just want to make sure I understand that, let's say my home state is Iowa, as the example was given, and they're in the SciPact. If I come to Alaska, while I need to provide some piece of information or otherwise sign up with the Alaska authorities so that they know I'm in Alaska providing services?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, no, you do not have to notify the jurisdiction.
And then
go ahead, Senator Klayman.
The other question I had is the language that's in this bill is the recommended language from SciPact. If we take the language and make small adjustments here and there, but it isn't exactly the precise language that you provided us, does that make it so that you wouldn't consider us part of SciPact, or would you look at the general spirit of what we wrote, and if it was close in all the essential features, you would allow us to become part of SciPact?
Thank you for the question. It depends on the changes. The contract is, it's been stated, it is a contract and all of the states have enacted the same legislation. There are some changes that in grammar and things like that that can be looked at. If you make substantive changes, that would have to go before the commission and they would have to look at it to see if it impacts the other jurisdictions that have enacted the compact.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Klayman. A very important point. I think it goes to Senator Tobin's earlier point there, like, there's a small language. There's language that maybe needs to be cleaned up, but wouldn't make substantive changes. Well, thank you, Ms. Orwig. And, yes, Orwig and Mr. Regenden for being here. We're going to move on now to the EMS compact. Ms. Harbison, if you please present the sectional analysis.
For the record, Arielle Harbison, staff to Senator Dunbar. Sections 32 and 34 establish recognition of EMS personnel licensure interstate compact. You can find the interstate compact on page 88 of the bill, line 24. Replica allows licensed EMS personnel, EMTs, advanced EMTs, and paramedics to cross state lines and immediately provide care under a recognized privilege to practice without a separate license in each state they enter. Eligibility requires an unrestricted home state EMS license at or above the EMT level and operation under the supervision of a licensed medical director. A provider scope of practice in a remote state defaults to their home state scope unless restricted by that state. Replica also includes provisions to expedite licensure for veterans and military spouses. Disciplinary actions in any member state automatically affect a provider's compact privileges across all states, and a centralized database tracks licensure and adverse action information.
Thank you, Ms. Harbison. Next up, we have Mr. Woodyard. He's the Executive Director of the Interstate Commission for EMS Personal Practice. Mr. Woodyard, I have had the good fortune to already hear a presentation on this, as has Senator Myers. One thing I'd like before we close, if you could please stress, is my understanding of this compact is a unique feature is that Alaska can keep its own EMS qualification, which in some cases is sort of lower, I don't know if lower is the right word, but has different training requirements than the EMS compact. So is that correct? And then can you run through as much as your presentation as you can?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and the committee. It's good to be here. And it's actually good to be here in person. Alaska EMS stakeholders invited me here to speak at conferences and meet with them. So I've been here about 1 week. I go to Anchorage tonight, Fairbanks later on in the week. And it's been great. Quickly to your question, and the answer is yes. The EMS compact does recognize, very much recognizes, that Alaska does have two levels of EMS clinicians that are unique to Alaska. The EMS compact does not change those levels. It does not impose any different standards on those levels. You can keep those levels. Everyone licensed in those levels can continue to practice. Of note, the individual's license on the Alaska-only levels would not have a privilege in the other states. That's probably not surprising because it is very unique to Alaska. But every other level in Alaska would be part of the EMS compact. No changes are needed. You have the same education, the same exams, the same requirements. And in fact, when I first came to Alaska 7 years ago, your stakeholders invited me here to analyze what would Alaska need to do to be able to join the compact. We're 7 years later. A tremendous amount of work has been put in place by your Alaska stakeholders to get to this point. And part of that was preserving those two local levels. That's very important. I will just make a few points. I know the time is getting late. You've asked questions about military. The EMS compact does respect military. It provides an immediate privilege to practice for everyone in EMS, and it expedites state licensure for those in the military. We've heard a lot of different compacts and a lot of different models. The EMS compact is very similar to the driver's license compact, a compact that I'm actually using today. And that is based on a qualified state license. The state will recognize an equivalent license in another state because the standards have already been aligned. The state gains full authority to hold individuals accountable. There is no fee charged for our compact. I will repeat that. There is no fee to the state. There's no fee to the individuals. There is no money exchange for the MS compact, similar to my driver's license compact. I do not pay or register. However, another question came up about how do you know who's practicing? The MS compact requires every MS clinician to be affiliated with and approved by an Alaskan-based EMS agency. You must use Alaska practice standards. You must have an Alaska physician medical director. What the compact does set aside is the need to file the paperwork to get an Alaska license if you are coming in and out under the compact. But other than that, your local Alaskan employers gain access to the national pool of EMS personnel through a more expedited mechanism. They're never required to use someone from the compact. And Alaska also significantly gains access to the National EMS Coordinated Database. I heard a question earlier related to, would you know about discipline otherwise? EMS is a little different. And the answer is no, you do not know about discipline except through the EMS Compact database. And that is unique to EMS. Currently, when someone applies for an Alaska-based license, if the individual self-discloses that they were licensed in another state and self-discloses they have discipline, you know about it. But there is no other coordinated database for you to search for EMS personnel. The EMS Compact closes that extremely important loophole that exists currently. Every compact state, currently 25, with 450,000 personnel, report in real time to the coordinated database. And that not only means that if Alaska issues discipline, it goes to the database, but if any state puts in discipline, it goes to the coordinated database. Alaska preserves your state's authority and autonomy and sovereignty to make your own decisions, meaning that if you discover that someone's got license discipline, we do not tell you what you have to do with that discipline, but you are provided primary source information to make decisions about the licenses you issue. The only caveat is if someone is disciplined in any compact state, their compact privilege is removed. And that means if someone has a compact privilege, you have the assurance that they have a clean background, they're discipline free, they meet your same education standards that you have in Alaska, and that they are free to work here in your state and affiliate with a local agency. The final point I would make is that when it comes to wildland and disasters. Alaska has a lot of wildland fire movement, both into the state and out of the state. The EMS compact streamlines that significantly. I believe your state EMS office has 6 personnel. In my previous life, I was a state EMS director in 2 states. I understand what it's like to license personnel. And I also understand what it's like to be in a small office staff state. I would propose that the best use of time is not to issue temporary licenses to perhaps hundreds of people, and the compact would free up time in your state so that those individuals could come in, be properly locally affiliated. The state gains authority. You gain the ability to investigate, hold people accountable, and it allows your staff to focus on Alaska. I'm happy to take any questions. You've had a lot of compacts today. I'm here to hopefully answer any of those that you have.
Thank you. We'll start with Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It might actually be a better question for Mr. Webb. I'm just curious about the training requirements and where those training facilities are located. I know here in Alaska, we have a program called EMT One Bridge, which just looking at the website, you can get those classes in Gustavus and Bear Creek and Cooper Landing. I understand that that is different to get some of the training or some of the testing requirements, and those are only located in specific places. So I'm just curious about that component and what the possible impacts might be, not just to the wildland firefighters, but to the folks who are doing first responding in our rural communities.
Mr. Chair, may I to the first part, and then Mr. Webb can answer the second part of that question, I believe. Again, the MS Compact does not change anything with Alaska currently today. So across the state of Alaska, you have people who today can choose to do an Alaska-only licensure exam. You also have people who can choose to go through the national exam, and you have a network set up with that. But I would defer to Mr. Webb and the state office for any specifics.
Mr. Webb, do you have anything to add to that to address Ms. Senator Tobin's question?
Yes, I do. And through the chair, it's Brian Webb from the Department of Health. I'm the state EMS training coordinator, so I'm uniquely capable of answering that. The what was being asked for was the EMT-1 bridge course, and the EMT-1 bridge course is specifically for our first responders who are emergency trauma technicians, which is not a state certification or licensure. It's a certification through Southeast Region EMS Council. It's owned part and parcel by them. So what we do is we take these ETTs who have 80 hours of education, and then they can go into an EMT-1 bridge course, which provides approximately another 80 hours to bring everything up to the EMT-1 level, and then they're state licensed as an EMT-1. And those programs are all over the state, from even the Bethel area, Southeast, everywhere's around the state. And those are administered largely by independent EMS educators that are certified by the Alaska Office of EMS. And on that, I will mention that our training programs absolutely 100% do correspond to the national level. The 2019 National Scope of Practice update that Alaska underwent, that was to upgrade us all the way to the national level, exactly what the National Registry of EMTs require for their EMTs or AEMTs and such. And then also all of our EMS training programs comply with the 2021 National EMS Education Standards. Once more, the same education standards that the National Registry uses. So we're totally in compliance with the National Registry. All of our programs are in compliance with the National Registry, and that's why we can cross over so easily. So I hope that answered the question.
Thank you, Mr. Webb.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
So if someone went through that bridge program to get their EMT-1, under this compact, would they be able to then take that training and license and go practice under the compact in another state?
Yes, and through the chair to Senator Tobin, that answer is yes if they choose to do so. And anybody that goes through an Alaska EMT-1 course, they're able to take the state exam, and also if they choose automatically, they can take the national exam as well in one fell swoop. So yes, they can, but again, it's voluntary to get their national registry, and then it would be voluntary for them to join the compact to be a compact EMT.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Thank you, Senator Tobin. Senator Klayman, we'll have this be the last question. I think folks are ready to go.
I'm happy to follow up at the next hearing if you're going to hear this bill
again. We are definitely going to hear this bill again.
Let's take it up at the next hearing.
Okay, I don't know if Mr. Woodyard will be here next time, but perhaps we can have you on the phone. And I'm glad you didn't come to Alaska just for this hearing. Hopefully other things going on. But thank you very much for being here, Mr. Woodyard. Thank you, everyone, for this hearing. As a reminder, we will not be holding a meeting on Thursday, April 2nd. So our next meeting will be Tuesday, April 7th. We will have two bills and one resolution, not including this one, and then we will shortly thereafter bring this bill up again. So for now, I'm setting it aside. Thank you, everyone, for a productive hearing. The time is currently 5:05, and this hearing is adjourned.